On this episode of Skeptico.
I call it the Stockholm syndrome of the parapsychology community. People who are taken hostage start to identify with the hostage takers and start to sympathize with them, right? At least some members of the parapsychology community longing so much to be one with the physicalists that they are attempting to come up with a physical explanation that will capture the phenomenon that they're researching.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, remote viewer Paul Smith joins us to talk about his new book, The Essential Guide to Remote Viewing. He also dishes a little dirt on 9/11 remote viewing, and in a segment that I highlighted in the intro that you just heard, he talks about parapsychology. And as I was putting together the show, I was reminded of a very, very brief instance I had of, I guess you could call it, remote viewing. And it's such a minor event that it's hardly worth telling. But because it happened to me personally, I guess it has special significance. You know, at our house, one game that I used to like to play with the kids was hide and seek. All kids love hide and seek, and my kids were no different. The way we used to play it was at night in the backyard, and we have a relatively big backyard, so it was a good game to play. You could really hide, especially in the dark. And we used to play it where the finder, who was usually me, was given a flashlight and then had to go and try and hunt through all the bushes and everything and find everybody. And the kids almost always managed to not be found. At any rate, one day, I think I had done a Skeptico show on it or something, but I decided that I would try and psychically see where they're at. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. Almost instantly, as soon as the thought crossed my mind, I saw my oldest son and my oldest daughter crouched beneath this play structure. It just came in a flash. But because I'd never experienced anything like that before, and because the feeling was so strong, I had a sense that it was real. I immediately ran to that spot, flipped on the flashlight, and there they were, almost in the exact position that I had seen them in my mind's eye. It was quite an unbelievable experience, and although I didn't make too much of it, it always stuck with me that, one, this stuff really can happen, and two, I definitely had the sense that this was something that was beyond what traditional science could explain in traditional means. It just felt like something more, something different than my normal day-to-day experience. So I was reminded of that because in today's interview with Dr. Paul Smith, he not only has some great insights into remote viewing, but he's, in a way that we talk about on this show, looked at the broader question of how science, and in particular, parapsychology, can tackle these questions scientifically, and I guess ask the question, can they tackle them in the way that we're going about it? So this was a very interesting conversation. Do stick around for the part about the 9/11 remote viewing of Courtney Brown and why Dr. Smith thinks that maybe doesn't stack up. I'm not sure it doesn't stack up, but anyway, it's an interesting controversy. It's an interesting interview. I hope you enjoy it. Here's former military psychic spy and remote viewer Paul Smith. Today we welcome remote viewing expert Dr. Paul H. Smith to Skeptico, who, before earning a PhD in philosophy from the University of Texas at Austin, spent more than 20 years dancing among the shadows of U.S. intelligence agencies as part of the government's psychic spying program. Dr. Smith is here to talk about his new book, The Essential Guide to Remote Viewing, the book that should be, I think, of great interest to anyone interested in remote viewing or our, in general, I guess, our government's attempt to kind of wrangle the paranormal in and use it for military purposes. The book is receiving widespread acclaim from both insiders as well as people who just find it very a readable introduction to this topic. So, Paul, it's great to have you back on Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
You are quite welcome. I'm always happy to talk to you. In fact, I should have done it more often. It dawns on me that I probably should have been on your show shortly after finishing my dissertation, because it would have been perfect fodder for conversation at that time.
Really? What was your dissertation on?
Well, first of all, of course, it was obviously aimed at philosophy, but the argument I was trying to make is that physicalism, which is the doctrine that runs science and runs our Western culture largely, which is that essentially everything is physical or the result of some physical fact or influence, that physicalism actually is false, and the reason we know it's false is because of the quite successful parapsychology research that's been done over decades, and particularly fairly recently as well. Essentially, because parapsychology demonstrates real effects, that shows that physicalism, which denies anything that doesn't fit in the physical paradigm, it denies anything of that nature exists. But because it exists, it shows that physicalism is wrong, or at least incomplete.
Great. That is great stuff. It's stuff we talk about all the time. And I think your point there is terrific, and you probably made it better than I do, but I kind of drill that into people because it took me a long time for me to kind of get that. But the basic premise of this reductionistic, materialistic science that we're burdened with is that consciousness can't do any work. It can't do anything, right? And as soon as that's falsified, which, as you point out, is falsified all over the place by the parapsychology literature, then that model really runs up against the rocks, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it's interesting that materialist physicalist science essentially puts down parapsychology because they allegedly can't show any there. And it's true. We can't show the causality for parapsychology, for any kind of ESP, such as remote viewing. We know it works and we can demonstrate effects, but we can't explain how it happens, right? Well, the irony is that physicalism is kind of the same boat.
Right.
Physicalism is kind of a circular logic. Basically what they say, and I'm oversimplifying this, but I documented in the dissertation, basically what they say is everything in the world is physical, and if you run into any phenomenon that appears not to be physical, then ultimately you'll find out it's physical, right? But the ultimately you'll find out they never actually managed to accomplish.
Right. It's the old give me one miracle and I can explain the rest kind of logic. Yeah.
Well, I like the old joke where, you know, you sign into a new workplace and they say there are two rules in this organization. The first one is the boss is always right. And the second rule is if the boss is ever wrong, see rule number one.
See rule number one, right.
And that's kind of how physicalism works. You know, everything is physical, and if you find something's not physical, well, you're wrong. It is physical. And that's essentially the argument.
You know, that really is a very good way of putting it. Exactly. Because that's what I was going to say is, you know, I think also in this broader sense of critically thinking about science, which I think is so important, you have to come to grips with the idea that you just touched on about falsifying, right? There's tremendous progress to be found from merely falsifying an existing theory, even without replacing it with a new theory or an understanding of, as you say, the causality of what is going on. If we just recognize that there's a natural phenomena here, which is kind of the first step of science to say something is going on here. We've observed it. We've tested in different ways of teasing out whether it's real, and it is. You know, it's happening to these variety of different people in different situations and all this stuff. So it really is happening. And then we can say the implications of it in this case, parapsychology, is it falsifies an existing theory. And it seems like we want to kind of dance right past that and go, exactly like you said, well, it can't, because that theory cannot be falsified.
Yeah, and of course the whole falsification model was come up with by Karl Popper back in the early, first half of the 20th century. And he turned it on some of the darlings of science as well. So, you know, and the fact is that it's kind of like mainstream science says, you have to live by these rules, but we don't necessarily have to.
Yeah, right. But let's talk about remote viewing.
Okay, all right. Well, in a way we were, because that's kind of the foundation that ultimately remote viewing came out of. So.
Well, in a way we were, and in a way we weren't, which is a whole interesting thing that I want to get into, because in the productization of remote viewing, and I don't want to say commercialization because we can't really say that it's commercialized at this point, but there's a certain degree of kind of, you know, in the old quantum physics world way back in the turn of the 20th century and the early 1920s, they reached that shut up and calculate decision, right? Where there's all this strange stuff going on at a quantum level that totally upsets the reductionist materialistic model we were talking about. And some guys just kind of got together and said, hey, look, wait a minute. We can either try and pursue that deep philosophical angle, or we can just use the results of what we're getting here and shut up and calculate and figure out how we can use that. And there's a certain amount of that at play here too that I see with remote viewing. So yeah, we can talk about the philosophy of it, but really your work in this book isn't at all philosophical. It's talking about the kind of shut up and calculate part of remote viewing, right?
That's right. And there's a certain argument out there. You'll find a lot of the psychologists and the remote viewing scientists, if we can use that term, who are trying to come to grips with the foundational elements of it. What is it that makes it work? What is the causality? In an attempt to make it acceptable to physical science or mainstream science, right? That's their approach. There's this other whole school of thought saying, you know what? They're never going to accept it on those terms. They always find some reason to explain it away. But if we're making money with it and it demonstrably works in an environment where you actually put it to practical use, then essentially the fight is over. People start using it. It works. That just ends the argument right there. You know, and there's certain legitimacy and value to that. People were certainly using magnetism long before they ever figured out how it actually worked and how it fit into physics, right? They didn't know what it was, but they sure knew they could use it, and they did, and there was never any argument whether magnetism existed or not.
Yeah, but in a way, that sidesteps the much deeper, dare I say, spiritual implications of all that. I mean, I think that's why the quantum physicists backed off of it. And I think ultimately that's why the RV people have nowhere to go with science. It not only undermines the current model of science, I think it undermines the reality of science in and of itself, because what it points to is a whole non-material world of consciousness that starts having a lot more ties to spirituality, the wisdom traditions, God and death and all that other stuff that has to be brought into the picture. So I don't think it's reconcilable with just a little tweak in our science here or there. I think it's much more profound than that.
Well, I actually kind of touch on this in the book. I don't hit it very hard because my goal is to show people that there really is some substance to the whole thing, right? But I do talk about the relation of ESP, parapsychology in general, and remote viewing in specifics to the world of physics. And I would probably phrase something a little differently. I wouldn't say it undermines science. It doesn't undermine science. What it undermines is this metaphysical view that all there is science. Right. So,
which I think are one and the same. I mean, because here's the one thing I'd say about science, and I guess I'm defending my position because I wrote a book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. And the premise of the book was that science is fundamentally in the business of measuring. Science must be able to measure in order to have a science. And as soon as we introduce all this stuff that we're talking about in the paranormal with extended consciousness, we have to put a big asterisk on everything that we measure, because we have to say, well, we measured it to the best we could, but we had to leave out this extended consciousness factor, or even the consciousness factor.
Well, the fact is, frankly, what the business sciences is in explaining, right? That's its business. And measurement is its primary tool. And so if it can't measure something, it can't explain it, and therefore it denies it exists. That goes back to the rule number one, rule number two, the boss is always right, right? So another analogy I like to use, that old joke about the drunk under the streetlight looking for his keys. And they say, well, why are you looking? Where'd you lose your keys? Oh, way over there. Why are you looking here? Well, this is where the light is. Right. So that's kind of the way science works, is it works where it can see it works under the streetlight, even though the answer might be somewhere out in the dark. And it rejects anything that is outside of that cone of light that it's working within. This is unfortunate. But the fact is that remote viewing and ESP and the spiritual elements that may be behind that actually don't do anything to physics, right? Physics is its own domain. But the claim that everything is physical is a metaphysical claim. And notoriously, metaphysics you can't prove in a scientific context. It's just kind of an assumption. I happen to agree with you, actually, that I've come to the conclusion that consciousness is actually a neighboring force, if you will, a primitive force in the universe that is not subject to physics, that is actually independent of physics. And that it's a second, and who knows how many there are, but let's say a second or even first is probably primary. So it's a first existent in the universe, and consciousness and physics can interact, but they are not the same thing.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I don't know how we would ever prove that, but I totally agree that when we are honest about laying all the data out and trying to sort it, it certainly fits better in that model than it does in the existing model, which just the only way you can make it fit is by ignoring all the stuff that you don't like.
Well, you know, there are psychologists who think you can fit ESP, et cetera, into a physics paradigm. They go to quantum non-locality, which I'm sure you've discussed on your show before.
Yeah, but that's all just bullshit. They're just trying to kind of fit in. I mean, where do you go, if you're a researcher in this field, if you want to do a total end run on science? I run into this all the time. And that's the general problem with parapsychology, and why parapsychology is going nowhere, is they've sold their soul more or less to mainstream science in order to get invited into the conferences, in order to get some respectability to what they're doing. And what they found is that it's kind of a total switch at the end of the day, where they go, oh yeah, you're respectable, you're just no longer meaningful in any way. And as I've said on this show before, near-death experience research is in danger of kind of doing the same thing, where, yeah, they'll let you into the tent, but at the end of the day, you're going to turn around and see that they've now watered it down to where there's really, you have nothing to say that's meaningful.
Well, I was going to say about the non-local/quantum entanglement explanation for ESP. Frankly, I don't believe it. I don't think they can explain what happens in a so-called psychic environment or psychic experience with entanglement. It doesn't meet the description of what the experience is like. I think that's actually a dead end. It's interesting you mentioned the near-death experience. I think probably what you're talking about is this attempt to explain these experiences in terms of what I call them brain hiccups, you know, where they're real experiences, but they're only inside the brain. You're not really going out of body. You're not really having a near-death experience in the terms of some kind of something ethereal or spiritual. What you're really doing is your brain starved of oxygen, or the neurochemicals have gotten a weird combination. So you have this experience, which is a real experience. It just isn't what you think it is. Is that kind of where you're going with that?
Well, I mean, that really is the neuroscience direct assault on near-death experience, which I think has been pretty thoroughly refuted and by the near-death experience researchers. Yeah. I guess I was kind of talking a little bit about inside baseball, and sometimes I see folks who, most people in near-death experience science, are still just saying, well, that just is foolishness. It just doesn't conform to the data, and they're holding to that line. But I guess what I'm worrying about, and what I'm out there kind of sounding the alarm is guys, you got to hold to that line, because that's just following the data. We don't want to start backpedaling and going, Well, maybe we do need to understand, and there is a compromise position with the neuroscience, resuscitation, you know, all the rest. It's like, no, there isn't. Yeah. That model doesn't work, and this model points to something else. And even if we can't say what it points to because we don't know the mind of God, we can still say the data that's coming in from this does not conform to your neuroscience brain-based model of consciousness.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I like to call that, in fact, I've started a paper on this. Ultimately, I'll get it published, get it finished and published. I call it essentially the Stockholm syndrome of the parapsychology community. You know, Stockholm syndrome is where people who are taken hostage start to identify with the hostage takers and start to sympathize with them, right? I kind of see at least some members of the parapsychology community longing so much to be one with the physicalists that they are attempting to come up with an explanation that captures physical explanation that will capture the phenomenon that they're researching, right? And I agree with you. I don't think there's a physical model that will ever explain it. And that's a conclusion I come to in my dissertation, is essentially the odds are, and of course, in science, and parapsychology for that matter, you can only go on odds. In fact, human knowledge itself is based on probabilities, essentially, right? So the odds are that there is no real physical explanation for parapsychology effects, because they aren't physical.
Exactly. That paper sounds wonderful, outstanding, and I don't think there's enough of a discussion about that, because the other thing that you're really drawing out there, I think, is we have to be real about the pull for that, you know, that these are human beings, number one, and they're professionals, and they're seeking to kind of have some kind of career, to put bread on the table and all this stuff. But there's also the peer pressure to fit in the existing paradigm. And until we're really honest and say that, hey, this is a social enterprise as well, and that, of course, there can't be a purity and stuff like that, then we can have more compassion and say, oh, okay, so now I understand how this could happen the way that Dr. Smith is saying that this Stockholm syndrome could take effect to these, you know, very intelligent scientists. Because otherwise people look at it and they just go, oh, that couldn't be. That couldn't possibly be true.
It is really a sociological game to a great extent. I mean, science always has been. I mean, if you look at how much the majority rules, even when the theories are wrong, and right. how there's this massive inertia to keep from changing once the science has been proved to be wrong on some cause effect relationship or some explanation of natural phenomena or whatever. I mean, that's the whole history of science is massive inertia that finally gets overcome by a blizzard of facts and ideas. And it's, well, I mean, that's what Thomas Kuhn wrote about, and this whole idea about paradigm shifts. That's how science works, and ironically, science works that way because that's how humans work in general.
Right.
Science
right.
likes to think it's something independent of human nature, but it is not. It's very much a child of it.
Right. Excellent. Okay. This is great. We could talk like this for a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm going to switch gears here for a minute and jump right into some prepared questions I have for you. Not directly about the book, because folks, you're going to want to check out this book. If you're at all interested in this topic, and you should be, right? Because even if you're not interested in remote viewing per se, as you've just heard Dr. Smith talk about, this connects with two essential elements to our life. One is science and the whole idea of what is science and how we fit into science and what consciousness has to do with our current understanding of science, but it also fits into government, right? So what is the military doing, and how are we supposed to understand in our increasingly military-centric, intelligence-gathering-centric society, you know, what are they doing with the paranormal, with ESP, and all the rest of that? So my questions to Paul are really in this general vein, but they're not directly about the book, because you need to go out and get the book and read it. I think you'll really enjoy it. So with that, back at episode 166 of Skeptico, I had a chance to interview Psychic Spy number one, Joe McConnell, who you reference in the book. And one of the things that I found fascinating about my conversation with Joe back then was him telling me about how, you know, Joe was a spy, you know, and he was doing this East-West thing on the German border with back when there was an East Germany and West Germany. And he is then poisoned by the East Germans and he has this heart attack. And on the way to the hospital to try and revive this guy, he has a near-death experience and he leaves his body. He sees them working on him. He sees the ambulance and he goes off into heaven and has this unbelievable experience. And he's brought back in the hospital. And who does he see in the hospital facing him in the eye is his handlers, right? And they go, hey, what happened? You know, you were poisoned by the East Germans. What happened? What do you know? And all he can do is tell him about his near-death experience. So this is, I'm recounting here what Joe told me in the interview, but where this comes into play with remote viewing is that now, a few years later, he's being interviewed by Hal Puthoff at SRI as part of the Stargate project, which you talk extensively about because you were there from near the very beginning and were deeply involved in that project from the very beginning. And he's being interviewed as a potential psychic spy in here, and they open up his top secret package and they pull out his file along with the book by Raymond Moody about near-death experience. And the reason I go into that long, long story was because to me, it makes clear that the United States intelligence agencies were aware from the beginning of the connection between near-death experience and its ability to transcend consciousness and enter this extended consciousness realm, and psychic phenomena, ESP phenomena, remote viewing phenomena. So what do you believe about that connection? And what do you think our government makes of that connection between NDE extended consciousness and psychic phenomena?
Well, unfortunately, I think today our government makes nothing of it because they abandoned it. And I don't think they're forward thinking enough, at least at the higher levels, to do anything with it. But all that said, obviously they were very interested for a long time. In fact, you can trace the history of interest in parapsychology in the U.S. intelligence community back to the 50s. And even more so in the 60s, MKUltra, which of course is infamous for a number of reasons, wasn't just about LSD, which is, you know, LSD or mind control, which is what most people focus on. It had a broad spectrum of things that it investigated. One of them was parapsychology. Interest, the reason for it, and we're not talking at a high level, but they were examining what the Soviets were up to, because they were, the Soviets were crazy about parapsychology. They're spending lots of money on it. So MKUltra, and then, of course, along came Hal Puthoff and Ingo Swann with their essentially innocently done experiment that really kind of blew the doors off of this whole government involvement in parapsychology. The government immediately became interested in an actual active way. Instead of just monitoring it, they became interested in an active way. And for a period there were a lot of individuals and a lot of influential folks in the government, in Congress, in the Senate, in the Army, in the Air Force, who were very intrigued by this, in the CIA, I shouldn't leave them out, the CIA, who were very intrigued by this. And I don't know what role the civilian culture played in it, because of course that was the time when, from the 70s on, for about 20 years, was when the civilian community was very interested in mind-altering experiences. Charles Tart's book on alternate states of consciousness was big during that period, and that may have played a role in people inside the government, you know, influence brokers in the government being interested in it. Whatever the case, there was a period when significant elements in the military, in the intelligence establishment, were fascinated by this and were promoting it. The problem, of course, is that you always have two poles. You've got the ones who are supporters, you've got the ones who are detractors. And there were plenty of detractors in the military as well. These are the guys who, oh, that can't be true, and even if it was true, I wouldn't have anything to do with it, you know, whatever. And those guys went out, unfortunately. But it was a pretty interesting period, and unfortunately, since the government canceled it in 1995, generally speaking, the skeptical community has been trying to suppress the realities of what was going on there. I've been talking for a while here. I should let you get another question in, but
well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's 50 questions. We're not going to have time to handle them all because it's fascinating. It's fascinating. But there's a couple of jumping off points from what you just said. And the first one, before I talk about the 1995 and what's really at play in terms of the denial that anything happened, which I think is a really interesting topic, I want to go back and really talk about this spiritual element to it, because I'm not suggesting you're bringing the spiritual into it, because you're not. It's not in your book. It's not your primary focus. But I am, because here's a guy, Joe McConnell, who touched heaven, right? I mean, that is his account. And it's consistent with all these other near-death experience accounts. And as soon as we accept, like we were talking about earlier, that there is this extended consciousness realm that we don't understand, and then we start looking broadly at the data and saying, there does seem to be some order to this extended consciousness realm, and there does seem to be a moral imperative behind this extended consciousness realm, then I immediately wonder, what does my government make of this? What do they make of the spiritual implications of this? Because they obviously have known about it and touched on it. And what you're telling me, which is fine, you know, which I can understand too, is that, well, they just kind of ignore all that and just try and operationalize it, which we should add in your other thing about MK Ultra. They're also doing demonic stuff, right? So they would just as like, hey, well, let's see if that force works too, you know? So demonologists, you know, and they were doing Aleister Crowley way back in the 1940s, but in the it buried in that work in the MK Ultra work and after that, there's other CIA projects that have been declassified where they were using demonology too. So they're playing with this stuff and they don't even know what it is, but they're trying to, you know, weaponize it or use it in some way. But maybe what I hear you saying is not so much. They just were kind of willing to just kind of let it slide.
Well, yeah. And I don't know about the demonology stuff. That's actually the first mention I've heard of it in terms of MK Ultra, but, remember, that was Sid Gottlieb, who was definitely an out-of-the-box thinker. He was in charge
right.
of that whole project.
Right. And I shouldn't have connected it directly with MK Ultra because it was another MK project. But if you go out and search the internet, it's there, and there's no reason to think that they didn't do that. I mean, there's no reason to think that that isn't true.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to mention here that the potential spiritual implications to remote viewing and general ESP may have been part of what put some of the folks in the government off. They didn't want to go there because, first of all, it kind of smacks as getting religion entangled with government. Second of all, maybe it made them uncomfortable to even think about in those terms. We do know that some of the opposition came from, for example, a particular congressman. We had really strong supporters of Congress, but we had detractors as well, and one particularly strong congressman rejected the program. Because he thought it was a work of the devil. He was a bit of a fundamentalist, had fundamentalist believers in his staff, and they thought, well, it may well work, but if it works because Satan's involved, and we don't think the government has anything to do with it. So you do get some issues like that. So
interesting. So there's a group, like you said, there's a group of just non-believers and it kind of the materialist, atheist, scientific crowd, like couldn't possibly happen. I don't know what those guys are doing, but they're wrong. And then you have this polarizing force on the other side and say, oh yeah, that sounds like something that could happen, but it's the work of the devil. And since there is some degree, we would hope, of oversight, of governmental oversight, the project just kind of can't keep its momentum. Is that kind of what we're hearing?
Well, yeah, actually, my original book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, I actually document a fair amount of this, where we had a lot of supporters. The program continued, I won't say unchanged, because it didn't go unchanged, but it continued consistently from 1972 until 1995. So obviously there were some forces at work in the institution to keep the thing alive, right? But that was a very checkered history because they had to come up with different funding streams. It had to leave one agency and go to another to continue, and that was because of the opposition. So, for example, and the Air Force picked it up from the CIA. The CIA got in trouble for a bunch of other things, and William Colby, the director at the time, said, get out of anything that is immoral, illegal, or controversial. Well, remote viewing is neither illegal nor immoral, but it certainly was controversial. And so the CIA jettisoned remote viewing in 75, and the Air Force picked it up. And the Air Force had it for 4 years under Dale Graff, who was really the savior of remote viewing during that period. And they had some amazing successes during that time. One was finding a Soviet reconnaissance aircraft, all kinds of top secret codes in it that had crashed in Africa. That one was even substantiated by Jimmy Carter. He verified that happened, that remote viewers found the downed aircraft when nothing else could. And we're talking about in the entire continent of Africa. That's pretty impressive. They also showed that Soviet psychics could actually defeat the MX missile shell game basing plan that Carter was so hot on. They wanted to all throughout the Great Basin, they wanted to build these racetrack shelters, kind of like a shell game where they'd move missile from one to another to another, and so the Soviets wouldn't know where the missiles were, right? Well, help put off at SRI, the folks did a study, and with some help from Charles Tart, that showed that a Soviet psychic could actually, with 100% accuracy, enough trials could predict where a missile would be in a given shelter. And that contributed to the demise of the MX missile basing plan. So what happened was the chief of staff of the Air Force at the time, the MX was his baby. The Navy had its tridents. The Army had its, there was always a need for the Army. The Air Force, their manned bomber thing was going out. So what do we do next? Well, we've got the Minutemen, but they're getting old. Well, let's build this new missile, right? And so the basing plan was awesome. It was a really great solution, they thought. Well, that was the chief of staff of the Air Force baby. And when he found out that remote viewing contributed to it, he essentially shut down the Air Force remote viewing program and essentially kicked Dale Graff out of the Air Force. Dale moved on to DIA, where he continued to support and act with the remote viewing program when DIA picked it up.
DIA is Defense Intelligence Agency, right?
Yes, Defense Intelligence Agency.
Well, it's an amazing history, and as you just mentioned, and we covered this in the last interview we had with you, folks can go back and look in the Skeptico past shows, but reading The Enemy's Mind, you do a great job of kind of documenting some of these great spy versus spy stories about the East-West conflict. Maybe you want to touch on that just a little bit. A little while ago, I had an interview with Lloyd Auerbach, who, along with Ed May and retired Soviet psychic spy Viktor Rubel, has written a book chronicling this back and forth spy versus spy kind of thing that was going on between us and the Soviets. What was most important about our interest in the Soviet-Russian effort towards psychic spying? Well, how did that drive what you were doing as part of Stargate and the other remote viewing stuff you did for the military?
Yeah, of course, the remote viewing program would not have existed if the Soviets weren't involved in this. We had a history of...
And by that you mean they weren't involved with us. We were chasing what we perceived as their advantage.
Right, they had a program. Yeah, they had a massive parapsychology program, and the CIA didn't know why, which is why they essentially hired Hat Putoff to find out. Because as far as the CIA was concerned, it was relatively ineffective. But if the Soviets put that much money into it, they didn't never spend a lot of money on something they didn't think was going to work, right? So they got us looking into it, and sure enough, it does work. And so the CIA actually became one of our biggest customers, even after they shut their involvement down. They were always giving us taskings over the next probably 10 to 15 years. Because the Soviets are involved in it, we had to find out if it worked. We found that it did work. And then an interesting illustration of how the Soviets kind of dictated some of what we did indirectly was we had our stealth aircraft program going on in the mid-80s. And the security folks of the stealth program got concerned about how They're concerned about how well the Soviet remote viewers might be able to get information about our stealth aircraft program, which at the time was compartmented, it was highly secret. Even the military folks didn't know it existed, right? It finally was revealed, I think, 1988, roughly June of 88, something like that. But before that, it was really tightly secret. Not even people with security clearances could know it existed for the most part. So what they decided to do is test what the Soviet remote viewers could do by tasking us. They couldn't ask the Soviets, obviously, but they could ask us. Now, what they did was they just gave us a number, which stood for tell us about the American stealth aircraft program. Of course, no one in our office was completely double blind, knew it even involved an aircraft. But in the process, a series of viewers were run on this coordinate, and it wasn't, I don't think it was that long, I think it was what we call an encrypted coordinate. But either way, you wouldn't have learned anything from that number. And that was all we had. And we started describing this aircraft. It was had bat-like wings. It had special skin that was radar absorbing. It had radar countermeasures. It was, highly secret kind of a thing. We essentially described Andrew sketches that surprisingly accurately represented the stealth aircraft.
So you were spying on yourself, our own folks, and showing that remote viewing had the ability to pierce top secret layers of kind of clandestine information. So what was the fallout from that?
Well, obviously we never dealt with the clients that we remote viewers. We were insulated from them because there was a real strong desire not to have us polluted by any accidental information, right? So we never were involved with these guys. But the story that got back to us was we actually, this was hair-raising for the security folks because we substantially described this aircraft, right? And they were very concerned about it. In fact, the feedback for it, we never got to see any feedback on it because it was highly classified. So we never got feedback until the newspapers in June of 88 started reporting on the stealth aircraft program, and we instantly knew that's what we were doing. All we had to do was read the newspaper article. We had no other confirmation whatsoever. We instantly knew that that was what our target was.
There's an interesting kind of point to draw out. Well, let me take it in a slightly different direction, because in episode 284 of Skeptico, just recently, I interviewed psychic detective Noreen Rainier, who I understand recently presented at the RV conference in New Orleans.
Yes, we've had her several times at the remote viewing conference. She's always an audience favorite. They absolutely love her.
Great. Well, I think Noreen's really, really a neat person. And, one of the things we did on the show was I replayed a deposition, a court-ordered deposition of an FBI agent who recounts Noreen predicting the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan in front of a bunch of FBI agents. So, anyone who has doubts, and they shouldn't, from reading your book, there's just anyone who is on the purely skeptical side of this and just thinks this stuff is total baloney and doesn't happen. I mean, that's just a crazy idea. You've just been kind of brainwashed there. But if you read Paul's book, but I presented Noreen's case because it's also, here's a court deposition of an FBI agent saying, yeah, he told all us FBI agents that Reagan was going to be assassinated in just the way that he was, on the right side, by a bullet, all this stuff. So it's a pretty amazing story. I think it adds to her credibility. But the thing I want to bring up about my conversation with Noreen is she said, hey, recently I did this kind of black ops thing for this group that was looking for this deposed general in Africa. And she didn't get into the details, obviously, and I would hate to even think about what the details are. But I thought of two things immediately relative to your work. Is one, clearly this stuff is still going on. There's still, why wouldn't it? I mean, there's got to be a huge group of people inside the intelligence community that knows how powerful this stuff is. So one, this stuff is still going on. It's underground. They use remote viewing protocol, but by virtue of the fact that they use Noreen Rainier, who doesn't use the same protocol, just uses her psychic, whatever she describes her psychic ability as, they don't care. They just want results. What does that say about what is the ongoing connection between the paranormal and the intelligence agencies of the U.S.?
Well, you know, I said that they'd shut down the program and that the power brokers in the establishment aren't interested and don't care about it. That's true, but that doesn't rule out the possibility that that folks are still using it in the military and in the intelligence world, which they are. Particularly after 9/11, a lot of remote viewers, former military remote viewers and such, were approached by mid-level folks who had some intelligence contingency funds or whatever, and were asked to do remote viewings on various security, national security issues. Myself and my little group of viewers actually did one for an Army major command. They were looking for a soldier who'd been kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I think. I don't remember who the outfit was. Somebody kidnapped him from a convoy in north of Baghdad, and they knew he was dead by that point. They're trying to find his remains, and they had no luck with people on the ground, so they contacted me, and we worked a project for him. The operations officer general from the major command actually was the one that interacted with me. And we produced a lot of good data. Ultimately, they found the guy, and we never got any feedback. I don't know if our input helped or not. I can't tell you a happy ending story here other than that they succeeded in what they needed. But I do know that we were asked to do that, and it was an official request. So people... And I'm going to say that wasn't the only thing we did, but you know, that was one I can talk about. People are still interested in the government. It's just that they have to be creative in how they get that, the assistance of remote viewers and such, because the power structure itself doesn't support it.
That leads me to something else I kind of wanted to ask you about in two parts of this, but you reference in the book Courtney Brown, who's another remote viewer, came on later in the project. But Courtney Brown, under his organization called the Farsight Institute, recently released an extensive remote viewing of the 9/11 events and came to the conclusion that, to kind of keep it short, that it was an inside job, that it was not as it's told to us, and that there were other people involved at either an intelligence level outside the United States or at some other agency, but that it wasn't as it was as it has been portrayed to people. I guess there's a bunch of questions about that. One, have you remote viewed 9/11, and can you confirm or deny anything that Courtney Brown found out? I guess I'll just start with that.
Okay, so 9/11 is something I keep trying to avoid and still get in fights about. But first thing I want to make clear, Courtney Brown actually was never in the military program. He came along later in the remote viewing history, you know, sometime after the program was, about the time the program was shut down, he got interested in remote viewing and interfaced with Ed Dames and had some training and experience with Ed, and then went on to form his own organization and so on. He's got quite a controversial history, as people know. In terms of his project on 9/11, I really don't trust the data there, or at least the conclusions, right? First off, I don't see any real reason for thinking that 9/11 happened any other way than anybody than the official report is. People think I'm naive in that. But if you look at the conspiracy theory ideas, they're crazy. I mean, the idea that the building was imploded is just ridiculous. If you've ever seen a building rigged for implosion, you know that you couldn't walk into there and not know it was going to happen. And we know there were thousands of people in those buildings, unsuspecting. There's no way that it was rigged for an implosion. It's just ridiculous. If you watch how they came down, you actually watch how they come down, you find out they come down differently than an imploded building comes down. They actually come down consistently with the theory that was expressed, you know, the planes crashing into them and so on. I don't get into all the details.
But we have to get into a little bit of the details, or we don't have to get into any of the details, and we just have to remote view it. I mean, that's the advantage of remote viewing.
Well, so here's the problem with remote viewing.
Because hold on, let me just throw on the table, because I can't leave that go, because I come to a completely different conclusion. And I think that in a way, what you've done is what I run into all the time, is, and what you suggested at the beginning of the show is the problem that the reductionists run into. It's like, okay, how did it happen? How did it happen? How did it happen? No, I don't have to say how it happened. All I have to do is falsify the existing theory, you know?
Yeah.
And I can do that in a score of different ways. And there's so much information, we can't get it out here. But the ringleader, Atta, is known to be a cocaine-using, stripper-going guy down in Florida who is nothing like this Muslim terrorist that we would believe.
You have to understand the Arab mind.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, then we can just stick to the evidence and look at Building 7. And Building 7, that has nothing more than couch fires, is a 47-story steel frame building that collapses into its own frame. There is no explanation for that. But more importantly, we can just look at the investigation because, like so many things, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up that reveals all. I mean, there was a non-investigation, and the head of the 9/11 commission that investigated is still calling for the release of documents that he says are critical, that he wrote and he was a part of, and he says there's no reason to keep these documents private, but they are. We have Dick Cheney and George Bush, who never testified in front of anyone with any kind of really ability to question them. They insisted on being questioned together. They insisted on being questioned in private. They fought the investigation as long as they could. They underfunded it. I mean, these are all telltale signs, and it's one of a million different data points that we could do that point to a falsification of the existing theory or the existing conspiracy theory that's put forward. But
okay, so this is what I suggest. We're not going to come to a meeting of the minds on this topic. So I suggest we avoid the conspiracy theory.
Well, you started it.
Well, no, you did. You asked about Courtney Brown and 9/11.
Yeah, no. But you started by saying that the building fell and it didn't look like implosion.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't even bring up Judy Wood or I didn't bring up any of the rest of that stuff.
Yeah. The reason I brought that up is because you can mess up a remote viewing project by having a theory to begin with, you know, an agenda, so to speak, right? You start off with a certain theory about what happened. Now, Courtney Brown says he didn't have
exactly
have a preconceived notion about it. I'm not sure that's true, but whatever. The problem is, it comes out in the analysis. You know, I normally don't like to talk about other remote viewers in public in negative terms, but I was at the conference of the Society for Scientific Exploration where Courtney Brown got up on the stand and said he did research that showed that by November of, I think it was 2009, 2011, something like that, that the San Francisco airport would be destroyed by an earthquake, right? He got up on the stand, claimed his remote viewing showed that. As we all know, San Francisco airport is still in perfectly good condition, right? So he has a history of reporting these things, and I think it's in the analysis. He actually has some pretty decent remote viewers working, but I don't think that their results necessarily consistently show what Courtney Brown thinks they do.
Have you seen their results? Their unedited videotape of their results. And I don't know that anyone could really look at their remote viewing and come to a different conclusion. It's pretty cut and dried.
I will admit I haven't watched the videos on these. I've seen other work that his folks have done, and they do pretty decent remote viewing, but then he comes to a different conclusion than I would if I were analyzing what the results were, right? So I don't know. I haven't gone into great detail here. I sort of, because of past experience, I tend not to feel like I want to waste my time sorting it out. But no, I have not seen his viewers' data. But you have to remember as well, there's a thing called telepathic overlay in remote view. I'm not saying that's what happened here, right? I'm not saying that's what happened here because I haven't actually seen the results. But it can happen in remote viewing. It's called telepathic overlay, where it can happen two different ways. The first one is if the tasker, the project manager, whatever, has a certain theory or an idea about what happened, and it actually is false, but the viewers, for example, I'll use an example of a UFO event.
Hold off on that because I want to tee up a UFO question. So, but I get your point about the overlay. Of course, you know, that gets into a whole can of worms because that cuts both ways. Like I'm saying, I mean, there, you know, you lived in this shadowy world, although you were kind of cut off from it, right? Because you were just tasked to do this job and you didn't know what was going on the other end. But hell, I mean, anyone who's objective says these people are doing nasty, dirty stuff all the time. I mean, that is the nature of our intelligence operations. So, you know,
all intelligence operations, not just ours.
Not just ours. Right. Okay. Let's all be patriots and say how great we are. But we're no better than anyone else. So we're torturing, we're killing, we're overthrowing governments. We're doing the worst of the worst kind of things. We're shooting depleted uranium missiles into Iraqi churches and schools, not because we want to, but because sometimes we miss. But it asks the question, why are we even shooting depleted uranium ammunition into our environment and destroying it? But we do all that stuff. Everyone does that stuff to us. It's we're in this big soup. So I just resist the idea to think that, you know, the telepathic overlay, we can't even consider that maybe, you know, some offshoot or some other agency was involved in 9/11 in some way that we're not told about. Hey, that has to be on the table. I mean, we shouldn't take that off the table. So how would we stop an overlay one way or another?
Well, it all depends on who's doing the tasking and how they do it. I mean, we at Fort Meade understood very well how to avoid telepathic overlay. And unfortunately, there are some folks who don't believe in it, even though I've seen plenty of examples where it absolutely happened, right? So it just has to do with doing it right, doing remote viewing right. Now, every once in a while, you end up having it happen even if you've taken all precautions, because sometimes if you're doing a multi-remote viewer project, you have, let's say you have three remote viewers, one of them gets this AOL, analytical overlay, which is, of course, a mental construct that isn't true, right, isn't accurate, but they get a mental construct, their imagination steps in. They have this really strong idea about what they think they're remote viewing, and sometimes that bleeds over onto the other viewers as well. And I've seen that happen, where one viewer had, you look at their data, and this one viewer has this completely wrong story, and you look at the others, and they all are seem to be following along with that same wrong story, and you don't actually have any real data about the intended target. So that can happen, right? Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often if you do the tasking right, if you have people involved in it who don't have preconceived notions about what it's supposed to be and that kind of thing.
Well, the other thing that Courtney Brown brings up, and maybe you want to speak to this, but he says that he has also encountered instances where there's an attempt to block the remote viewing. Is that something you're aware of and you guys discovered in your operations?
I have never had that experience myself, and I have never seen any credible instance in other remote viewers of that happening.
Did you guys explore whether the developing an ability to block other remote viewers? Because it's a natural thing that I would expect they'd want to do. I mean, if we know the Soviets and our enemies are doing it, we know we're doing it. I mean, it's just defense.
Well, you see, that whole idea of blocking remote viewing sounds a bit like a meme from a science fiction story. I mean, I used to read all these science fiction stories.
Yeah, but all this stuff is science fiction. I mean,
well, no, but I'm talking about the interesting thing about when you spend a lot of time with remote viewing, you start to realize what is possible that you didn't think was possible before, right? And you also start to get a feel for what is really unlikely in terms of claims, because you hear all kinds of claims. You know, a zillion people have different ideas about what they're doing, what works, what doesn't work, and a lot of them are not very strong critical thinkers, right? And so they don't even self-evaluate to see if they really know what they're talking about. But, you know, in the old science fiction ESP books, you know, people would, they'd be telepaths or whatever, and then you develop these blocking mechanisms, you could block other telepaths and all that kind of stuff. And I'm telling you, I don't know how that would work, because the way remote viewing works, I don't see how you can block it, frankly. And like I said, I've never seen any instance where it was blocked. Now, of course, you'd say, well, what about the science didn't work? Maybe there's blocking going on. Well, who knows, right? It's very hard to sort out. But that's the second part of my response to that is, how would you know you'd been blocked? How could you possibly know whether there's any blocking going on, right? I think that's, frankly, I don't believe it. I'll get right down to that and say, I don't believe, remote viewing can be blocked, and B, even if it can be, you would not know you were being blocked.
See, that's the part that troubles me about all of this, is that I think we're talking about a realm that we so don't understand that I'm uncomfortable when we start saying, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. I mean, back to my earlier story, we have no idea how any of this works. We have no idea how Noreen Rainier stood in front of those FBI agents and told them that Ronald Reagan was going to, there was going to be an attempted assassination on his life, and it was going to be exactly the way that it happened. Now, she's not right all the time in these predictions, because in some way we don't understand. It does seem like predicting the future seems a lot more difficult than recalling events in the past or recalling events in the present. But just because we can observe those and put some kind of statistics on it, we shouldn't, I think, jump to the conclusion that we understand how any of that stuff works.
No, you're exactly right. We don't understand, which is why when somebody says something definitive like, oh, you know, you can block remote viewing, that's why I'm suspicious of that claim, right? Because we don't know how it works. And so my only recourse there is my own experience and my understanding of the process, which is actually twice or three times as long as Courtney Brown's. I mean, I've been in this field since 1983, and I've had many different kinds of experiences.
Fair enough. You have a tremendous amount of experience, and we have to value your opinion. I'll see what – I've never spoken with Courtney Brown, but I bet you as a result of this interview, he'll want to talk. So,
well, I'm probably going to get an earful, because once he hears this, I mean, he'll probably listen to it. He's going to be annoyed, which, you know, he's entitled to be annoyed. I mean, I gotta
take up for him a little bit. He is entitled to be annoyed a little bit, because in the interviews that I've heard, it sounds like he has gone to great lengths to address the exact issues that you're talking about. One is blinding his two remote viewers, who you said seem to be extremely competent, and I would have to say, looking at their credentials and what they've done, seem to be very, very good remote viewers. He completely blinded them. He addressed the issue that you talked about in terms of the cross-contamination, either directly or psychically between the two. And then moreover, what he has produced and put out for people is a complete unedited version of their remote viewing session. So anyone can draw their own conclusions from it, but I certainly didn't see him overlaying his preconceived notions.
And I don't have a problem. I think he has been very good about the remote viewing protocols themselves. But as you know, in science, the devil is often not in the research. It's in the interpretation of the research, right? And that's what I often have. There's two things I have issues with. I probably ought to move on from Courtney Brown, or he's going to be mad enough as it is. But but there's two issues I've had with him ongoing. Is his interpretation of the data and the kinds of targets he picks. It's like he wants to, I shouldn't be talking about this over in public, but he wants to have the knock it out of the ballpark success in remote viewing, right? One that proves to the entire world that remote viewing works. To me, it makes more sense to try and actually understand how it works, have more basic research. I wrote about this. We have the International Remote Viewing Association has a competition called the Work-Collier Prize. Right, where it's for the best proposal for a remote viewing experiment for any given year. And I wrote an article, and people kept coming up with these really elaborate, really kind of hard to execute, and sometimes even hard to verify experiments. And I'm thinking, you know, we don't need to have these really complicated things when there's so many basic questions that still need to be answered. So I wrote an editorial saying essentially, look, come up with something that's elegant and simple that will reveal a fundamental fact about remote viewing. You don't have to come up with these shake the world loose from its foundations kind of experiment. And, you know, and I really think that's good advice generally for the remote viewing field. There's so much we don't know about how it works. And you yourself have said that, right? There's so much we don't know about how it works. And we need to push that boundary out, because the more we learn about how it works, the better we're going to be able to do it, and the more accurately we're going to be able to do it. And I think that's where the research ought to go. So in any case, I've already said way too much about Courtney Brown. Let's go on to a different topic.
Okay, let's go on to a different topic, but I want to pursue that in a couple of ways, what you just said, because in a way, it's a topic we've touched on over and over and over again in this interview. And you know, you are a spiritual guy. So I know that from our last conversation. And I don't want to get into directly your spirituality, but we can if you want. But I have to take issue with what you said, because I think the burning question for people are those bigger, deeper spiritual questions. Who am I really? Why am I here? And this work that you do starts approaching those questions in a very deep way. And that's why my first question in this show was to connect with Joe McConnachal, because Joe McConnachal had an extended consciousness experience with God. That's his experience. So you can do with it what you want, whatever your religious overlay you want to put on that. But that's his experience. And that's the experience of thousands of other people. And that stands in direct contrast to what science is telling us, what our government is telling us, and this overall meme that we are biological robots, the world is meaningless, life is meaningless, don't worry about it, don't think about these deeper things. I think that's where this research really hints. So, you know, whether you like Courtney Brown's approach or not, I understand your problems with it, but I'm not so sure I'm totally comfortable with the shut up and calculate, just do a good remote viewing project so we can find gold in the hills or whatever. Why not show this to be the opening salvo in a total reorientation of who we are as human beings and what our relationship is with the higher power that is within us?
I'm actually not quite sure what your vision is there.
I don't have a vision. I'm just saying we're it's bullshit. We're being told that over and over again by our government, by our science, that we are biological robots. Don't worry about it. It's meaningless. And this science of remote viewing tells us otherwise.
Well, the fact is that every successful remote viewing session, it counts against the physicalist hypothesis, right? Every successful, it doesn't matter what the target is. Every successful session shows that the physicalists are wearing no clothes. For example, if you're going to remote view alien bases on Mars, that there's no feedback for that. There's no way to show whether you're not just making something up with that, right? That kind of remote viewing experiment actually carries no weight whatsoever in the direction that you're proposing here. And yet a lot of folks want to go there, and it's mostly out of curiosity and the search for novelty and excitement and sensationalism and stuff, you know. I think that there are some, for example, UFOs, you're going to go there at some point anyway. I think that there is some legitimate use for remote viewing in exploring certain UFO phenomena.
Expound on that, please. What do you mean?
Well, for example, and you know, without coming up with a specific case, I'm going to try and think of.
I'll offer one, because back in one episode 179 of Skeptico, I interviewed UFO researcher Grant Cameron, Canadian UFO researcher, highly regarded. What he found is that since the 50s, and along with the MK Ultra project we talked about that had really a broad range of interest, one of the interests was to better understand the ESP link between the UFO phenomena and what we were understanding and beginning to understand about the UFO experience. Grant has done an unbelievable job of uncovering documents, Canadian documents, previously classified, released, in particular the Wilbert Smith memo, that says this is the highest ranking information officer in the Canadian government. And he says, hey, I went to the U.S. to find out about this, and they said, well, the UFO thing is real. It's our highest, most top secret thing. This is in the 50s. And it has some kind of connection with this mental aspect to it. So again, I hear what you're saying, that we can't verify when we remote view Mars. But I think we can't also ignore the overwhelming amount of information that suggests that our government has been deeply interested, involved, and has a greater knowledge of the ET and UFO phenomena than they ever want to admit. And that, I don't know what your opinion is, but somehow it seems to be connected to this telepathy that we're touching into when we look at remote viewing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't. I'm not quite sure what he's getting at. I know Ingo Swann had thought that there was a telepathic element in UFO-ET connection as well. In fact, your bigger question is actually one better answered by John Alexander. Have you ever had him on your show?
No, but please tell me.
Have him on and get his viewpoint on it. But, I mean, John is somewhat of an authority on UFOs. He just has a different perspective than a lot of the other folks that are on the bandwagon. But here's the thing. When I'm talking about using remote viewing as a tool for UFOs, for example, there was a UFO event, and I'm very vague on this now because I did the work back in 2000, but or maybe a little earlier than that. There was a UFO event over a lake in Illinois where a plane disappeared, and it long has been rumored to have been a UFO thing. Well, I was tasked by Skip Atwater, who is one of probably the best remote viewing taskers around, and certainly one of the most experienced, completely double blind on this thing, along with another remote viewer. And the ultimate outcome was that we determined, at least based on our data, that there was no UFO involvement, that it was a bird strike or something like that that brought the plane down, and it just because of the radar anomalies, it disappeared in a weird way, and the aircraft is probably in the bottom of that lake somewhere, just based on our double blind remote viewing data. Now, there's another case where Ingo Swann asked me, along with another remote viewer, to remote view the moon. Now, again, it was double blind. I don't say double blind. It might as well have been because I just got the task by mail. But in the process, I uncovered some interesting things about the moon that you would not expect to be on the moon. Essentially, intentional living systems of some sort. And so when I found out it was the moon, I was very surprised, right? So, and that could be useful in directing exploration. Whether or not we'll do that or not, who knows? We have no control over that. But Ingo had a question about some stuff that he'd heard about the moon, and in fact, some stuff he'd remote viewed. And so he tasked us on it to see if he could get some verification. See, to me, that's a useful way of employing remote viewing, and it has some problems, and it will be a while before we ever get feedback, ever verification, but at least it's within the realm of possibility if somebody ever wanted to look at it. But you can use remote viewing in a UFO environment to either establish whether a phenomenon happened or didn't happen. And another example, and I wrote about this for a UFO magazine article about remote viewing and UFOs. There was a South American minesweeper that was found abandoned and adrift in the Gulf of San Mateus. And over the course of 2 years, four remote viewers worked it, and all produced the same story, and it all involved a UFO. I was one of them, and I picked up that same thing, right? So that could provide some interesting details that could be perhaps looked into or researched later on. But that's using remote viewing the way it was intended, is to be used against something that you have peripheral information about, but don't know the full story. I mean, that's how we use it in the intelligence world. It's how you use it in missing persons cases. You know there's a certain person, the person is missing, you know the general area where they might be missing, you can use remote viewing to try and narrow down and isolate that person, and so on. That's how I think remote viewing is best applied in a practical way. Now, can you use it to explore spiritual elements as well? Yes, you can. I think that's usually best on a personal basis. When you start trying to make claims about the nature of the universe based on remote viewing as something that you can't get feedback on, then essentially it's not much more than speculation in that case.
Okay. Good. So I'll tell you what, Dr. Smith, in the time that we have left, tell folks a little bit about what you do, because, what you do nowadays, how you are applying remote viewing for clients, but also how you're helping individuals develop this ability for themselves, because a lot of people have interest in proving this for themselves by developing their own ability to remote view, and you help them do that sometimes, right?
Yes. Although I do operational projects from time to time, that is applying in a real-world setting, my main focus is trying to perpetuate the ability, the skill, right? So my primary focus is teaching and training people in remote viewing. So I have courses, live courses that I do in the summers here in Cedar City, because it's an absolutely beautiful place in Utah's color country. In the winters in Las Vegas, because you can't count on getting up to Cedar City in the winter thanks to snow. So anyway, but teaching is my main thing, because I can do remote viewing operations a few a month, and when I get too old to do it and retire, it's done, right? But if I teach a whole bunch of people how to do it, they can use it for their own purposes, but also we have a cadre of folks who have some confidence in the ability, and it helps preserve the skill. So that's my main thing. I probably make more money doing it operationally, but I gain more ground by teaching other people how to do it. Essentially, I'm trying to teach the world how to fish rather than giving them fish, essentially, right?
What's the best way for someone to learn this? Is it to come to your classes? Will this book help? And I think you also have, you're looking at doing some kind of DVD series to do.
Yes, that is now available. So I've always felt like the gold standard was a live course where you actually came and had the direct experience with an instructor who was very confident and familiar with the material. And I still think that's probably the gold standard. But the problem is, I teach one class a month maximum. So theoretically, my maximum number of students a year is 48. And that doesn't even count the folks who come back for intermediate and advanced training. So realistically, I get through 20 to 24 students a year. There are many thousand people who want to do this, and many of them can't afford to come and take a live course, pay my exorbitant training fee, and plus all the logistics and everything else. You know, my course is really intensive. I only take on two students per instructor, so you have a 2-to-1 student teacher ratio, and it's 40 hours. It's essentially the equivalent of a one semester college course crammed into 1 week, and so it's very intense. It's a very good experience, but I came to finally realize there were a lot of folks out there who either can't do that, and obviously there's a lot of people who even could but can't because I don't have space in my classes for them. There are a lot of folks who can't do it, and they're not going to ever have the opportunity unless they came up with something. So there's two things. The book is one. It's intended as an introduction to people who heard about remote viewing but don't know a lot about it, or who are involved in remote viewing and but have friends who are skeptical about it. They can give them this book. It's written from a very level-headed, even-handed kind of approach, and the book can work as a good, inexpensive introduction. But I've also got a course that's called Remote Perception Basic Operational Training. It's a 4-DVD home study course that captures the principles that I teach in my live training, and it gives people a chance who would not otherwise have an opportunity to do it at home, and at least to get a good grounding in the process and in the principles, and actually be able to remote view and develop their intuitional skills. So that's kind of an outreach thing. The virtue of the course, the DVD course, is that it's only 10% of what my live training is. So anybody can afford it. And yet it captures a lot of the principles that I have not actually been all that open about in public. I tend to treat it as a brand, if you want to find out about it, come to my class. But I've decided I need to have more outreach here if I'm going to have any hope of preserving this whole remote viewing technology for the future, even after I can't do it anymore.
Right. So, and your website's real easy to find, too. It's rviewer.com, but people can also just... very easy to Google Paul Smith remote viewing, and you'll immediately get to a lot of his stuff, right?
Yeah. If they're interested in the course, it's actually remoteperception.com, but rviewer.com will get you there as well.
Great. Well, you know, it's been great having you on. I appreciate your openness. We've talked about so many different things. I hope everyone can find something to get riled up about from this interview.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, it's kind of fun. I mean, you know, it might sound like we were arguing, but it's fun to be talking to a host who has a point of view and is willing to engage on the issues. I'm going to apologize to Courtney Brown now for throwing him under the bus here. He really is a nice guy. Personally, I like him a lot, but we do disagree professionally on methods and approaches. So, you know, I have professional disagreements with a lot of folks, and I don't want that to turn into any kind of personal thing. Keep it at a professional level, I think it will be fine. So, yeah, I know Courtney will disagree with what I said, and he's welcome to. I mean, he has his point of view too. So, anyway.
Hey, we wouldn't be really hitting the real issues if we didn't have some points of disagreement. And I think it's awesome that you are totally open, from what I found in both our interviews, and open and willing to engage in these, because that's the only way you're going to get any progress. People are just shut down. And I run into that all the time, you know, atheists and skeptics and folks and very fundamentalist religious people too, who, you know, just cannot engage because it so threatens their beliefs. And I feel like you are not threatened. You're willing to explore, you know, those beliefs. And
I have been known to change my mind on things. So,
well, haven't we all? You know, that's the.
Well, there are some people who haven't, actually. There are some people who don't. But, you know, if I hear a good enough argument, if I recognize that the argument is legitimate, then I've been known to change my mind on those things. So.
Great. Well, thanks again, Paul. It's been great having you on.
Nice talking to you too. Hope we have another opportunity soon.
Thanks again to Paul Smith for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview. Is parapsychology research on the right track? Have they given in too much to the materialist, reductionist, institutionalized science that demands that we look for a physical, neurological explanation for these phenomena? Has that compromised their position? Are they looking for the answer under the lamppost when they really lost their keys in the dark alley? It's a question I've offered my opinion on way too many times, so I think it's time for me to ask for yours. What do you think? Where am I wrong? Point me to some parapsychology researchers who would refute that notion, who are doing good work and are marrying good reductionistic science with an open-minded inquiry into these hard-to-explain psi phenomena. So tell me what you think. The place to do it, of course, is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can bounce over to your forum. Less and less people are going to the forum. I don't know why. I still get a ton of feedback on the shows, but for some reason, you guys have abandoned the forum. Come on back. It's a great place. If you come there, I guarantee you, I will join you in the conversation. We used to have some great ones over there. Let's have some great ones again. But you can also reach me on Facebook, send me an email. Many of you do that, and I appreciate it. The key is to stay in touch, keep this conversation going, keep this little community, which is just part of a larger community of people who are looking for answers to big picture science questions. But let's keep that going as well as we can. Also, do stay with me for the upcoming shows on Skeptico. I have some good ones, and I look forward to bringing them to you. But I guess that's all for now. So until next time, do take care and bye for now. Let's take a ride, a separate road to roam. With the sea breeze to leave us, then we'll never go home again. Just take your time and please take mine. Take mine.